Hello, and thank you for joining us on VOA's special broadcast commemorating World Refugee Day. I am Jackson Vunganyi, joined in studio by my colleague Nanit Talani. Nanit, it's a pleasure hosting this World Refugee Day special podcast with you. And joining us in studio is Olwak Shufto Gennaro, a young Sudanese American writer. Gennaro's new memoir tells the story of his journey from Sudan's capital, Khartoum, living as a refugee in Cairo in Egypt, and then resettling in the U.S. as a child. Thank you both for joining me in studio.
Hello, Jackson. Hello, Gennaro.
Hello.
Nice to be with you here. We know that every year, June 20th, is dedicated to raising the awareness of the situation of refugees around the world. World Refugee Day was first celebrated in 2001. It was to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the 2051 convention relating to the status of refugees that defined who a refugee is and set out also the rights of individuals who are granted asylum and the responsibilities of nations who grant asylum. But what is the difference between these terms and why is the distinction so important? Here is a quick rundown.
Refugee. A refugee is someone who is forced to flee their home country due to fear of persecution because of race, religion, nationality, membership in particular social group or political opinion, according to the United Nations 1951 Refugee Convention. UNHCR says 117.2 million people will be forcibly displaced or stateless in 2023. Asylum seeker. Asylum seekers are essentially refugees, but their claim to refugee status hasn't been evaluated and they have not yet received any legal recognition or status. There were around 5.6 million people around the world waiting for a decision on their asylum claims as of June 2023, UNHCR said. Internally displaced people. An internally displaced person, or IDP, is a person who fled their home but has not crossed an international border to find sanctuary. Even if they fled for reasons similar to those affecting refugees, armed conflict, generalized violence, human rights violations, IDPs legally remain under the protection of their own government, even though that government might be the cause of their flight. There are 61.2 million internally displaced people globally as of June 2023, UNHCR said. Migrant. Migrant is an umbrella term for a person who moves away from their place of usual residence for any variety of reasons, but not necessarily because of a direct threat of persecution or death. They may be moving temporarily or permanently, legally or illegally. Though the terms refugee, internally displaced people, asylum seekers, and migrants may seem similar, those groups are protected in different ways. For example, the International Convention in 1951 outlined certain rights for people deemed refugees, whereas migrants have no such rights. Refugees are protected from being deported or returned to situations that might threaten their lives. They should be given access to social services and integrated into their new country's society. Migrants, on the other hand, are subject to a country's immigration laws and procedures and can be turned away or deported back to their homeland.
Gennaro, thank you so much again for joining us. Watching that explainer, which of those terminologies or terms applied to you at any point in your journey?
First and foremost, thank you so much for having me, Jackson, Nanette. Watching that explainer, the term refugee absolutely is what applies to me and my family. Of course, the history of Sudan is very complex and it's unfortunately covered with conflict. And in the early 90s, there were a substantial amount of South Sudanese in the northern part of the country that ultimately had to leave the country through Egypt, Libya, and some of the other neighboring countries to the north, where the South, the story of Lost Boys is what comes to mind when people think of Sudanese, or South Sudanese rather, and of course them having crossed the borders into refugee status to the neighboring countries, which includes Ethiopia, Kenya, and Uganda. But refugee is the term that applied to me and my family and hundreds of thousands of other South Sudanese as well.
Okay, you know, Gennaro, next to you, there's a book. You wrote it. So does it reflect your experience as a refugee?
It certainly does. The book starts off, of course, with me narrating what I remember most from Sudan as a child. Of course, having grown up there and Sudan being my home, Khartoum being my home, and the experience outside of Sudan, ultimately in Egypt, which is, of course, an Arabic-speaking country, so it wasn't far-fetched. But through the eyesight, or through the perspective, rather, of a 9, 10, 11-year-old kid, it was still a different part of the world, different cultures, a different society. And, of course, the fact that my immediate family, friends, and people that I grew up with were no longer with me there, it was certainly quite a shift for me.
And your book is titled Shufto, which is also your name. Let's see the book.
Absolutely.
What does Shufto mean?
Absolutely. So Shufto is an Arabic term, which actually means seen it. So having seen something, having, you know, a sight, having seen something.
And like a witness.
A witness.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's a perfect way to place it. However, the name has multiple meanings for me personally. As I spoke with Jackson before, I told him that this name somehow made it into my family line, and my mom, who's very creative, thought it was a great idea to name a kid Shufto in an Arabic speaking country. So as you can imagine, growing up, that name wasn't too friendly to me. I've gotten more than into a couple of fights arguing about it. Of course, kids can be very creative, and you know, I considered it to be cool. But sitting here with you right now and speaking about my journey and my refugee experience, it really does kind of come full circle, where mm-hmm. I've seen so much in my 30-plus years of life, and so it was just kind of natural for me to you know, kind of incorporate that into the story.
And you share it with that in that book. The United Nations expects close to 1 million people to flee Sudan by October this year, most of them to neighboring countries like the Central African Republic, to Chad, Egypt, Ethiopia, and South Sudan. But most of those nations have their own challenges, with people displaced by conflict who face food insecurity and instability. Henry Wilkins reports from Borota, Chad, on what Sudanese refugees will face in their host communities.
16-year-old Saeed Adam Mohammed says one morning in May he rode his bike down to this patch of ground on the outskirts of Borota, a Chadian town about 5 kilometres from the Sudan border. He saw thousands of Sudanese refugees arriving.
People ran away and came over here, but there is no food or drinking water, no decent food, no clothing.
Some 425,000 refugees have now fled to neighbouring countries because of Sudan's civil war. But many of their host countries face their own conflicts and are struggling to feed their own people amid skyrocketing food prices and inflation. Experts and aid groups say Sudanese refugees face far from certain futures in host countries, including the Central African Republic, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Egypt. The mayor of Borota, Toko Bahat, says the community has done what it can to welcome the refugees.
In Borota, the people are from a mix of places like Kanga and Porto. They know one another. They are like siblings, since they come from the same families or tribes. So there is no problem in living together.
Similarly, in South Sudan, many of those fleeing Sudan are South Sudanese returnees. However, two-thirds of South Sudan's population already faces food insecurity and instability in Renk, where many refugees have arrived.
The difference with South Sudan compared to perhaps Chad or Egypt is that the majority of people who are coming across the border are returnees. Communities are quite welcoming, and of course we hope that continues. The pressure that this is putting on markets, on the humanitarian response, is definitely going to be difficult for humanitarian agencies and the government.
Most Sudanese refugees, more than 170,000, have fled to Egypt in recent weeks. Egypt's currency has been devalued by 50% against the dollar in the last year, while food prices have risen by 60%. the Central African Republic, where around 14,000 refugees have arrived, has been embroiled in a civil war for more than 10 years, and security is dire. Ethiopia, where thousands of refugees have fled, is recovering from a civil war that ended in November. Eritrea has been accused of forcibly turning away refugees attempting to flee Sudan's fighting. On a visit to Egypt in late May, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees commended Egypt for helping Sudan's refugees, but said, "We urgently need to mobilise more resources to help them to maintain this generosity." Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Barotta, Chad.
Okay, Gennaro, you watched this package with interviews, camps, and testimonies. Does this package triggers some memories from your days as a refugee?
It certainly does. Seeing it is just, again, very difficult to see how 20 years later, over 20 plus years later, the population of Sudan and South Sudan are still facing, the just absolute worst parts of conflict. When I wrote the book, again, I narrated in my perspective and what I remember as a kid. Mm-hmm. And so lots of it, of course, through the vision of a child is not the same when you reflect back and retroactively begin thinking about it. But seeing that, I can certainly remember certain, similarities or certain aspects of what's happening currently that were just kind of apparent, but not apparent in a way because of my probably, child mind trying to protect me from what was happening. From the trauma of it.
Now, again, as a child, were you aware of the situation that you were going through, whether in the movement from Khartoum to Cairo to the U.S.?
I was. So our transition or fleeing South Sudan at the time was very rapid. There was no kind of preparation, or my parents didn't exactly lay out a time frame as when we were leaving or why we were leaving, rather. It was just kind of something that happened. And of course, culturally, it's something we can probably all relate to. When your parents say, "Hey, it's time to go," you don't argue. You do what needs to be done.
So you didn't know anything?
I did not know anything about it. Probably within a week or two, my parents, explained to us that we were leaving the country, but not necessarily as to why we were leaving the country. And, of course, again, as a child, and me, I'm the oldest of now 7 children. Mm. At the time, I saw my role as, do what parents needed to do, what they needed you to do, because they knew what's best for you. And so that was really the end of that conversation.
Now, this is you leaving Cairo, going to, coming to the U.S.
You are only, 11 years old.
Were there any type of ceremonies performed by your parents, by your relatives, by your community, as they saw you off taking to embark on this new journey?
So leaving Cairo, Egypt, there was. I think I mentioned to you briefly that at the time there were lots of families that we became acquainted with. I had good friends by the time we were in Cairo and kind of readjusted to this new society and to this new life. So we've seen families leaving, and often what happened was parents got together, sort of a goodbye, sort of a gathering, but not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And 2 weeks or so, 2 months rather.
What kind of gathering? A happy gathering?
So it's really a mix. I noticed when we were leaving. Prior to that, I did not notice what the gatherings were about. It was kind of a ceremonial, seeing people off. But my own experience, when we were leaving, our parents got together with some of the close friends and the neighbors. And between the laughters and the jokes and kind of the advice that, the families and friends were given, I noticed that there was a tone of sadness.
There was a sense of melancholy.
There was. Mm. And as a child, again, I didn't quite understand it, but it really, looking back now, it really spoke to how much trauma or how much parents go about and really try to protect their kids from seeing sadness, from seeing hurt, from seeing just the fact that you're now disconnecting once again. And having to leave and having to, see what the world has to offer next. So,
you said you were very, very young. So what were you doing just to, so your younger one doesn't feel very sorry? Because you said you were the first one of 7 children. So if you were 11, meaning the other one were very, very young. So what was your role as a big brother?
Absolutely. So at the time, and this is speaking about the time we were in Egypt, mm-hmm. at the time I had 2 siblings, 2 younger siblings, and a third sibling that was born while in Egypt. So we joke around the family now and call her the sole Egyptian in the household. But my role was really kind of the support to the parents. Life was very difficult in Egypt. You know, my parents had to work, you know, many hours. So often I was the one who was responsible for
the caretaker.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was the caretaker. I took them to school. I brought them home. I actually attended school in the evening at the age of 11 because throughout the day I was taking care of all the other kids. I even learned how to cook to make sure that, you know, they're able to eat something before mom and dad got back at 9, 10, 12 o'clock at midnight. So I was really kind of filling that role as the caretaker, big brother, and any and everything that the parents needed us to.
Were your parents constantly reminding you of your position in the family or your position in society as a family, given that you are in a country that is not yours?
Not necessarily or not explicitly. It was implied in a way. I firmly understood by that age that I had a role, and that role was to essentially fill whatever space that my parents required me to do. So in my mind, I took it upon myself as, hey, this is your responsibility. And since, you know, parents are not home or they're working and taking care of everything that they need for us to get by, my role was to go to school and make sure that everything else is taken care of. So I understood that firmly.
Okay. Now, Gennaro and Jackson, it's time to go to Uganda in East Africa. Because this country, this nation, hosts the most refugees in the world. The country hosts over 1.5 million refugees living in different parts of the country. Uganda is also known for having some of the most refugee-friendly laws to ensure refugee rights and access to education, employment, and healthcare. We spoke to some of the young refugees in the country, in Uganda, about their experiences, and this is what they said.
My name is Ayoka Ben, and I'm from South Sudan. I've been staying in Uganda for the past decade and more, actually. My family decided to come here after the situation which started in South Sudan. So we sought refuge at the border, and from there we progressed deeper into the center city of Kampala. Some of the challenges I think would have to come with discrimination, because some people have refused to accept this change, accept us into their community, and try to believe that not all of us are warmongers and not all of us want to harm them or steal their things.
My name is Mahmoud Abdi Ahmed. I am from Somalia, especially in Mogadishu. I came here end of the 2002. So the people in Kampala, they are very friendly and humble. They were very welcoming me when I came here. So I wanted to thank how they are welcoming me. Now, alhamdulillah, I understand everyone living here.
My name is Rahel, and I've been there in Uganda for 7 months. It's hard to find some work for the youth, especially for Eritreans and Ethiopians. It's hard to find work. It would be nice if some opportunity would be given for the youth.
By the name of Bill Gabriel Joshua, I am from South Sudan. So basically, the journey that I've been having here in Uganda, it started all the way from 2013. I came here after the war. The journey has been tough. Nobody can say that the journey is always simple. It's always tough. So we came in here, we got knowledge, we tried to make a living out of it, and we thank God for that. We are so grateful about that.
My name is Bo Ter. I'm a South Sudanese by nationality. I've been in Uganda for quite long. So I've known, there's a lot I've known and I've learned from Uganda. So it's like, I'm used to it right now, it's like my country too. So being I interacted a lot with a lot of people in Uganda, like most especially the Ugandan people, most especially with my teachers in primary. I learned a lot. They are good people. They interact, they are social. And they're really good at helping each other. They teach us a lot in school, like help each other, be careful, be kind, and show love, most especially to your fellow Africans.
Now, Gennaro, I want to take you back, over 20 years ago when you first landed in America after you made that trek. How many 8 hours on the plane?
coming to the U.S., what were some of your earliest memories? Sometimes people say cultural shock.
Absolutely. So it was more like 12 hours on a plane, which is the first experience. And again, as a child, you kind of see things in so many colors that adults probably don't. But I remember the very first thing that I noticed in that, how large that plane was. And I couldn't wrap it around my mind how such a thing can actually be in the air, let alone be in the air for that long. So I didn't sleep for 12 hours until we landed in New York at JFK. Some of the very first things I noticed was, again, the diversity that I saw at JFK. I've never seen so many people, different shades in one place, moving at such a fast pace and not noticing how incredible this experience was. So that's one thing that I noticed when we first landed. And then, of course, as I mentioned, we ended up in Buffalo. That's where we were ultimately relocated.
Buffalo, New York.
Yeah. And the world of a difference between JFK, New York City, and Buffalo, New York. So those were kind of the very first things that
are
still...
You mean the big city versus a small city feel?
Absolutely.
Small town.
The biggest city in New York versus... Yeah. Well, technically, Buffalo is the second largest city in New York, but in comparison population, it's a small town. So those were just very apparent memories that I, until this day, still see very clearly.
I know one of my earliest memories coming in here, the first things that I remember is the cold, because I came in January. Did you experience that?
I did. Unfortunately for me, I was a bit spoiled because we arrived on April 28th, 2000. I remember the exact date. And the reason being the journey from the airport to our new home where we were living was just kind of a sensory overload. Everything from the visual of the trees and the greenery and the roads, the cleanliness of the road. And then the absolutely most interesting factor for me was the fact when we ultimately arrived at our new home, and I mentioned to you before during our conversation, I looked to my left and I looked to my right and I did not see a child in sight. Which is just an incredible thing.
Coming from a place where you see so many children all the time in every space.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Khartoum, of course, is a large city, so I was very used to that until it was time to go indoors. But in Egypt, it was lively constantly. So you saw people always, and children were always playing on the streets or something like that. And to take a look in the middle of the afternoon, and I don't see anyone around except cars passing.
That was a little shock.
That was just kind of very confusing.
You had to intake that and say, "This is my new world now. Children here."
I was wondering where the people were. That was the first thing in my mind.
Okay, Gennaro, you know, 20 years ago, there were not as many refugees as they are in America. So how did people perceive you as a refugee in your new community? How was the first contact with your new place?
So absolutely. The very first kind of early memories of our kind of adjustment to this new community, this new society, was, you know, the very few Sudanese or even Africans that I was able to meet for the first time. Luckily for us, we were, you know, in a part of town where it's very diverse, so you have people from all walks of life, and Buffalo has a very diverse
community. And you had a lot of Africans there.
And then, yes, I got to meet some new family. Some of my closest friends right now I met probably within the first couple of weeks of having moved to Buffalo. But, of course, it's a different society. The language barrier is something that's, you know, it takes time to adjust to. I didn't speak English when we initially moved here, so... It took some time to kind of learn what people were saying, and the other factor was we came pretty much at the end of the school year, so we had to wait. My siblings and I had to wait until the following school year, which starts in September, to enroll into school. Mm-hmm. But the Catholic Charities, the organization that sponsored us at the time, had programs for families, and they did a wonderful job, really helping our families and all the families that they sponsor adjust to the new society. Mm-hmm. So that was very, very helpful. But it, you know, it's something that's it takes time to kind of get used to.
Yeah, but you know, learning English is something. It's very hard. Even it's something I experienced when I came here like 7 years ago. I couldn't speak English. So it was very, very hard.
You
so,
would never tell that you never spoke English.
Very true.
So what I was doing is like ask my American friends to correct me. If I say something wrong, please let me know because I'm in the process of learning a new language. So how was the experience with you of learning the new language?
So my personal experience, I thought, was very smooth in transition. And part of the reason being, I'm just a curious, you know, character by nature. So I saw it as a challenge. It's kind of, it was similar to when we were in Egypt. And I had to adjust and learn the dialect in Egypt because Arabic in Sudan, in Egypt, and like many other speaking Arabic-speaking countries, is quite different. So to me, it sounded like a new language. So I had to kind of learn and work very hard at, you know, adopting and, you know, learning this new language. Mm. So it was a similar process for me with English. The only difference was I needed to really kind of pick up quick, because no one else.
You had no time.
I had no time.
You had to go to
school. How about your parents? I mean, I know kids, sometimes it's easier for them to adapt to these new environments. Your mom, did you see your parents, you know, struggle?
I did. Yeah. I absolutely did. And, you know, God bless their hearts because they worked very hard to also learn the language and adjust. And that's another aspect that I really wanted to point out in the book, which is that as a child is one thing, but for parents who are completely uprooted, not by a choice of their own, and having to readjust and relearn a language. I mean, I can't imagine trying to learn three different languages at this age now. But ultimately, having to adjust to the new culture, having to learn the new language, make new friends, you know, work, etc. Those are very difficult
new food.
Things to do.
Oh, the food, absolutely, yes.
The food is a huge
adjustment.
It took me a year and a half before I can eat pizza. Because I didn't understand why did it have
what
so much cheese.
What is bread with the cheese on it?
Right. So, but no, it certainly is a transition. And for me, I took it as a challenge and I needed to learn the language, not only for myself, but for my family as well, because ultimately I was the one who had to explain what this bill was for my parents, or what the school report reflected, or what, you know, whatever was sent from school for the kids that the parents needed to sign off on. So these things were necessary for me to come up to speed fairly quick.
Orak Shufto Gennaro, writer of the new book, Shufto, a memoir about your life story. Thank you so much for coming in today and sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. Every week, connect with our experts. You can ask them your questions and get their advice. Join me, Lino Mudu, in Washington on VOA's Healthy Living, your new health program, right here on KTN.
How do world events impact you? Your community, your country.
The cost of living, everything has changed.
And how do people and events in your part of the world affect the rest of the world?
When I'm in jail, you wake up every single one of my 20,000 sisters around the world. They will make noise for me. They will ask their governments why I'm in jail.
Every day, African nations with 1.4 billion people and the diaspora around the world help shape global conversations. Straight Talk Africa features the newsmakers.
Africa never got a Marshall Plan.
The decision makers.
I strongly support free movement of persons.
The change makers.
It's not fair that
70% of Africa is offline while the rest of the world is enjoying their access to internet.
We'll help you make sense of the news with insight, analysis. First, we go to VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir. She is at the UN headquarters and frontline reporting from our correspondents. We also explore America's story and its ties to Africa's past, present and future. Straight Talk Africa with me, Heidi Adams, on VOA.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in Welcome back, and thank you for joining us today on VOA's special broadcast commemorating World Refugee Day. My name is Jackson Vunganyi, joined in studio by my colleague Nanit Talani. And joining us today also is Konandike. Jeremy Konandike is president of Refugee International. His organization advocates for the human rights and protection for displaced people. He will be talking to us about some of the challenges faced by refugees and displaced people fleeing the continent and in different parts of the continent, plus some of the responses by the international community and agencies to provide help to millions affected by these conflicts. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Talk to us about the work that your organization does in terms of advocating on behalf of refugees and displaced people around the world, especially in Africa.
So we are an advocacy organization. We're an activist organization. We're not a service delivery organization, and there's a very specific reason for that. So much of what refugees need is not just food or water or shelter. They need legal services. They need protection. They need access to their rights. And often if they have access to their rights, they don't need as much of the aid. And so we were founded in the late 1970s after violations, egregious violations of the rights of refugees in Southeast Asia, where refugees were being pushed back into the killing fields of Cambodia by Thai border authorities. Now, that's not a problem that you can solve with aid. That is a policy problem, and it needs advocacy, and it needs pressure. And so we were founded 40 plus years ago to do that kind of work, and we continue to do it today.
Okay, so Jeremy, you know, today we have a lot of refugees around the world. So you mentioned some of challenges, but if we look in Africa, what are the main challenges refugees are facing in Africa and where they can get help?
So it comes down to refugee rights. That is really the foundation of everything. And if refugees have access to their rights, rights to work, rights to move, rights to education, then that will avoid a lot of other problems. So, you know, we really start with looking at the rights that refugees are granted in the places where they have sought refuge. And we see a really mixed picture, I would say, across Africa. There are some countries that are doing really increasingly well. You talked in the earlier part of the program about some of the policies in Uganda. I used to work in Uganda on refugee programs, and they had, even in the early 2000s when I worked there, some of the most generous policies in the world. They would allow refugees to move through the country. They would allow refugees to work. They would give land to refugees to farm.
Access to education.
Access to education. Yeah. So you go from that to, you know, to other extremes like what we're seeing right now in Egypt, where Sudanese who are trying to flee into Egypt, who are fleeing a worsening civil war in their own country, are in some cases being blocked at the border. Initially, Egypt was saying any male between the ages of about 16 and 50 would not be allowed to cross in without a visa, which meant functionally they couldn't get in. Now they're blocking an even wider wider range of people from coming in. Mm-hmm. So you have people who are clustered on the border with very little in the way of services, not being given the ability to seek access asylum in Egypt. Yeah. And so, you know, we really see a mixed picture depending on where you look.
When you talk about advocacy, who are you directing it to? Is it the governments? Is it the NGOs? Is it the UN? And what does it look like?
Yeah, all of the above. And it really depends on the issue. So with something like the situation in Egypt, we are going to be engaging with the United Nations, engaging with governments that have diplomatic relations with Egypt to put pressure on Egypt and urge them, not just pressure, but also urge them to do the right thing. We engage with the UN to urge them to provide the kind of support that Egypt needs to do that. Because, you know, it's also a hard thing for a country that doesn't have an architecture in place to receive refugees to suddenly receive tens or even hundreds of thousands of refugees. So that also requires the UN to step up, the donors to fund the UN to step up. And, you know, when you can work across all those different parts of the system, that's when you can start to see some progress.
I wanted to ask you real quick, when we talk about the laws, we talked about Uganda being one of the most friendly countries in terms of refugees. I know I grew up, was born as a refugee in Uganda, so I can attest to that. But usually, why are some countries friendly and others not friendly? What are some of the factors that really push that?
That's a great question. I think some of it just comes down to their history. Uganda had a lot of its own history of internal conflict, and people fled out of Uganda during the wars in Uganda in the 60s and 70s. I think that may have contributed to Uganda having a more generous policy. Kenya is an interesting example of this. So Kenya traditionally wanted to keep all of its refugees in camps. And so you talked in the earlier part of the program about the Kakuma and Dadaab and the camps in Kenya. Kenya really wanted to keep the refugees out of sight, out of mind, not let them down to Nairobi or the big cities, not let them have freedom of movement. There was a major policy overhaul, a new legislation that passed in Kenya in 2021 that made their policy dramatically more progressive. And so it is still in the process of being implemented, but there was a change, and I think Kenya came to see over time there are benefits to hosting refugees. And this is one of the points that we really make in our advocacy, is to point out there are benefits to refugee hosting countries. It's not just a burden, and those benefits can best be realized if refugees have rights. So if refugees have the right to work, they can support themselves, but they also then become consumers in that economy.
And contribute to the economy.
They contribute to the economy,
We'll continue our conversation with you, Jeremy Konandike, President of Refugees International. But let's go to Eastern DRC, that's the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, where armed conflict in northern Kivu province between the rebel group commonly known as M23 and the Congolese army continues to wreak havoc in the region. Civilians, including women and children, pay a heavy toll due to ongoing violence. Exhausted and traumatized, some find temporary shelter in camps for the internally displaced outside the capital, Goma. The violence so far has displaced more than 800,000 people as of March 2022, and some have fled to other provinces, including South Kivu and Ituri. VOA Africa Division reporter Omari Kaseko visited Goma and produced a documentary that focuses on the humanitarian crisis in the region. Let's look at a preview.
We are tired of wars. Parents and children are dying on the roads.
By the time they get here, they're right on the edge.
They had to cut me here so they can replace this part of my leg.
The biggest problem in this crisis is malnutrition.
Hunger is killing people. Many go to the forest to find food and they get raped.
He said, if you say anything, I will kill your child. We fought, but he was stronger than me. He raped me.
these brave women spoke to VOA in this documentary that will be released soon. Keep an eye out on our website at voaafrica.com.
Yeah, they are really, really brave. But it's so unfortunate that what groups say gender-based violence has been used as a weapon of a war during conflict, leaving victims with physical and psychological scars, both visible and invisible. But some activists and humanitarian organizations are fighting to stop sexual violence in their communities. Among them, there is Passi Mubalama. She's a founder and executive director of the Action and Development Initiative for the Protection of Women and Children, or ADEPROFEN. So through her organization, Mrs. Mubalama, she advocates for women's rights. She promotes democracy, good governance, and the rule of law in her country, DRC. So we spoke with Passi Mubalama earlier via Skype, and she explained how prevalent gender-based violence has become in DRC.
Sexual violence is really a huge problem, actually, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, as ADEPROFEN, Monique, different cases of sexual violence. I can say per month we can register like 100 survivors of sexual violence. When I'm talking about sexual violence, you know, it's not only about rape, it's also sexual exploitation, sexual abuse, psychological supports, forced marriage, and, you know, different cases of sexual violence. Most of the time, the author of sexual violence are armed rebels, or sometimes even member of the community, people within the IDP camp, as usually ADEPROFEN work with internal displaced people. The main reason is that most of women and girls are raped when they are collecting firewood, or, you know, trying to look or search for food. So it's really very, very difficult for them, because when they are collecting firewood, they can find armed rebels, you know, who rape women most of the time within the IDP camp. To set victim free, it's really important that peace, they get peace in their different villages, because living in the IDP camp itself, it's not a way to protect IDPs or refugees. ADEPROFEN actually is working on a project with the UNHCR, reinforcement of local mechanism on the prevention and response to sexual and gender-based violence in different IDP camps. We are in Rusayo, Lushagala, Muja, and in Masisi, and we are trying, you know, not only to prevent or not only to respond to sexual violence, but to prevent. As you know, most of the time, men are the main perpetrators, and we are trying, you know, to work with them on different programs like the positive masculinity, where we are training women on how they can protect women's rights. It's not easy because of customs and tradition in the Democratic Republic of Congo. But, you know, we are working with them to engage them in the protection of women and girls.
That was Passi Mubalama, founder and executive director of the Action and Development Initiative for the Protection of Women and Children. And we're still joined in studio here by Refugee International's President Jeremy Konandike. Jeremy, so limited funding has been cited as one of the major challenges in handling the refugee crisis in Africa. In what ways can the international community do better to support and protect the rights of refugees?
One of the big priorities that we are now advocating for is for more of that funding to go to refugee-led organizations. So a lot of the funding traditionally has gone to the big name-brand aid agencies, groups like UNHCR and UNICEF, World Food Program, and the major NGOs. And they really do very good work. But they also are huge global institutions. They're expensive. And, you know, sometimes they are more distant from the day-to-day needs of refugees than the refugee-led organizations are themselves. So we are, you know, we are calling on donors to find ways to channel more money more directly to refugee-led organizations themselves.
You know, Jeremy, we have seen a lot of scandals where the help given to refugees was used for other things, for something else. Yeah. So how can you make sure that the help you are giving to refugees will go to them directly?
That's a great question. I think that's a risk no matter who you work with, right? So just last week, USAID, where I used to work, suspended all food aid to Ethiopia. And that was because of corruption and manipulation by the government and by other actors in Ethiopia, by some of the, you know, some of the authorities in Ethiopia on both sides, kind of all sides. But that was a that was an internationally managed program. So, you know, it's not to say that somehow there is far less risk of that when you're dealing with international groups and far more risk when you're dealing with local groups. I think there's always risk, and you have to go in eyes open and manage the risk. And there are ways that you can do that. You can build accountability mechanisms. I think one of the most important things that we've found is, again, hearing from the people themselves on what they think of the aid they're receiving. Because if they're receiving poor quality aid, mm-hmm. or if it's not getting to them, the best way to find that out is by making sure you're building systems to listen to them.
Mm-hmm. Accountability.
In
1991, Hodan Hassan fled war in her home country, Somalia, and sought safety in neighboring Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp. Now, despite uncertainty at the time and having to move around from one refugee camp to another, Hassan finally settled in the U.S. And today she's a state representative in Minnesota, making decisions to chart the future of her state. Mahmoud Maskad sat down with Hassan for a one-on-one interview, and here is an excerpt of their conversation.
You know, I was a little kid, but I remember refugee being a really, really hard life where you have no safety, no security. You have no control over your life. And your food and your income comes from the UNHCR and the monthly rations that they provide. There are no jobs. At the time, there was no school. There was nothing. So I remember, you know, this small memory I have was very, very rough life and a hard life. Because of America is the reason why I am a state legislator today. Because we had a chance to go to school, we had a chance to work hard, we had a chance to rebuild our life. So that's what America means to me. It means a second chance for people who are fleeing from war, from famine, from destruction, from uncertainty. So what I do as a state legislator is we pass legislation that is refugee-friendly, program that supports people who are coming to the state of Minnesota to help them, you know, resettle, find a job, get training if they need, learn English. The other thing that we also passed was there are people who come here as refugees, but there are others who come here as asylum seekers, people who you know, come here, all different kinds, who don't have documentation. So the two highlights this year that we passed for people who are undocumented was driver's license for all people who come here by means that's other than refugee, that they can get driver's license. And then also healthcare for all people who are don't have documentation can also receive healthcare in the state of Minnesota. I have a wonderful message to the refugees around the world, especially young people. Do not despair. There's hope. There are a lot of people in the world who care about you. There are a lot of people in the world who want to support you. And there is many opportunities for you to find a second chance in life, to start over, to find a chance to settle in a space that is not, you know, full of violence that you're not worried about food to eat or where to lay your head. What I want to tell young people around the world who are refugees is that there is hope in the world. There are many folks who are willing to support you and help you.
Yeah, it's a very successful story. Jeremy, I know it's very hard to work with refugees because all of them are traumatized. Nobody can be forced to leave his country. It's very hard to go to somewhere you don't know anybody, sometimes with no money. So they are very traumatized, and some of them have gone through a lot of things like violences, sexual abuse. So do you have any like success story or something, an positive experience you want to share with us?
Yeah, I think stories like the one we just heard are really inspiring, and they show what can happen, what people can do when they are welcomed. And there are so many stories like that. You know, we have on our board of directors, we have numerous people who were refugees at one point in their lives. We have a man named Safal Ir, who's a refugee from Cambodia, and he's now a very impressive a professor of management at Thunderbird School, Business School at Arizona State University. He's on, he does all sorts of board and nonprofit leadership work. We have a woman named Katia Martone, who is on our board, who is a famous writer, has written biographies of Angela Merkel and other, other high profile books. And then, of course, someone like Ke Huy Quan, who won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor this year, was a refugee from Vietnam. Representative Ilhan Omar, who is now a representative from Minnesota. Yep. I think it speaks to the richness that refugees can bring to a country when they are welcomed.
Yeah. Now, Jeremy, when my parents were fleeing for safety to Uganda in the 60s, things were likely more different than they are now for refugees that are fleeing, say, from Rwanda or from the DRC going to Rwanda, from South Sudan to Uganda. What would you say are some of the changes that have happened, whether it's in the systems, whether it's in the recipient countries over the years, maybe, 40 years down the road?
One of the big changes is just scale. There are about four times as many displaced people in the world now as there were in the 2000s. And that is putting a lot of strain on the system. And so some of the stories that we're seeing in the news now, the boat that just sank in the Mediterranean yesterday, this awful, awful story. There are so many people, because there are so many more people displaced, there are more people trying to move, trying to seek safety around the world, and more people who are trying to reach the U.S. or Europe to do that. I think one of the really unfortunate changes that we've seen over the last 10 years is a less welcoming attitude in the U.S. and Europe. Mm-hmm. And, very famously, the Biden administration has been putting in place new restrictions against seeking asylum to deter people from seeking asylum at the U.S. southern border. They are also pairing that with some new ways for a few different nationalities to come. No African nations, unfortunately, are eligible for those parole programs right now. And in Europe, of course, they have this policy of trying to deter people in the Mediterranean and often making it harder to rescue them when they come across if their boat is in distress, as this one was. And there is this sort of notion in a lot of wealthy countries now that they need to deter people from seeking asylum. And, at our Refugees International, we just don't believe that works. If someone is in a desperate enough situation that they are leaving their home, they're leaving everything behind, they're fleeing their friends, their family, their livelihood, they're not going to ultimately make the decision whether or not to flee based on whether they think Europe or the U.S. has a generous asylum policy. Mm-hmm. They are trying to escape something. And so we really want to see, and this is one of the big priorities for our advocacy, is to urge more burden sharing and more generous burden sharing by some of the wealthy Western countries that, frankly, could take a lot more refugees than they do.
Right. Now, we're talking about mostly wealthy countries creating these, setting up these restrictions for refugees, for asylum seekers. Have you seen those changes in perception also taking place in more poorer countries, say, in Africa?
This is one of the things that we're very nervous about. There have been many times, I talked about Kenya earlier. For many, many years, Kenya would threaten every few years to shut down its refugee camps and send everyone back to Somalia, for example. And then there would be a round of humanitarian diplomacy by Western donor countries saying, please don't do that. provide more aid. And it's just much harder to do that credibly when the global refugee crisis is showing up at the borders of those same donor countries, and they're behaving radically differently than what they've traditionally encouraged other refugee hosting countries to do. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain, if I can say, ridiculousness to a country like the US or countries in Europe, which have vast, large populations, huge resources, saying, we're full, we can't possibly take any more, when countries like Kenya, Uganda, a lot of countries in the Middle East, Jordan, Lebanon,
with less
are hosting
resources.
Huge numbers with far fewer resources.
Yeah. Now, we have some questions from our Facebook listeners. We put out the question to you earlier, and the question was, what do you think the world needs to do better to help refugees? For example, some experts recommend that refugees should receive more humanitarian aid and have the opportunity to earn a living and have basic human rights in their countries. And we do have a lot of responses and questions here. We won't have time to go through all of them, but I wanted to go to this one question from Sharif Isma, who asks, who says people who leave their countries should still get an identification number or legal status in the country they fled to.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a core part of global refugee practice, that when someone is, you know, one of the first things that UNHCR will do, for example, when refugees cross a border, is register them. And countries don't always want that. So, for example, right now in Pakistan, there are 600,000 Afghans who have crossed new into Pakistan since Kabul fell to the Taliban. Pakistan is resisting registering them because they don't necessarily want to acknowledge that they are there as refugees. So that is a constant challenge.
So then what do you do in this case as an advocacy group?
It is really tough. I mean, our target at the end of the line needs to be the government of Pakistan. But I think we also need to, you know, again, it's a burden-sharing issue in part. There are already hundreds of thousands of Afghans who have fled in the last couple of years. We expect a lot more to be fleeing. And you can't expect only the bordering countries to bear that. They need, you know, they need encouragement. They need kind of urging to do the right thing, but they also need support, and they want to see that the rest of the world is not leaving this only on them.
Mm.
Yeah.
Nanit, do you have any
still
questions?
On Facebook, yeah. I find it's not a question, but it's a very nice comment. Mm. So it's from Dalatu Ibrahima Masare.
Yeah.
He said, refugees, they need nothing more than solve the issue that chased them away from their country and so they can go back there.
Yeah.
What do you think about this comment?
That's the fundamental issue, right? I talked a moment ago about how we have four times as many displaced people in the world as we had about 15 years ago. The reason for that is that crises are not being resolved. So, you know, the war in Syria has been going on now for more than a decade.
Over a decade, yeah.
The Yemen is still extremely unstable. South Sudan, most people have not been able to go back. And now, of course, what we're seeing in Sudan does not look like it will end anytime soon. So ultimately, you know, the global refugee crisis is a symptom, and it's a symptom of our failure, the failure of international diplomacy to solve the underlying crises and create those conditions for people to go back.
Jeremy Konandike, president of Refugee International, joining us here in studio, World Refugee Day special podcast on the Voice of America. I was joined by Nanit Talani. Nanit,
it was a pleasure working with you. And thank you, Jeremy, for coming.
Really my pleasure.
Jeremy backing all the way from DC to come to join us. Thank you so much. And if you have any comments, remember to check us out at voaafrica.com. We'll catch you next time. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye.